We're still on the theme, temptation does not mess around. And last week I shared a rhyme with you. And this week I have the second verse to the rhyme. Temptation does not mess around. It seems to peep up from the ground. Temptation does not mess around. From a notion of joy and praise, rebuke expound. Temptation does not mess around. And what have we found? Consumed by zeal, temptation abounds. And our praise of God becomes empty sounds. I invite you to come with me and peek into the temple of sounds. For Jesus of Nazareth has entered in what has he found? That temptation does not mess around. For the scribes and the sellers are no different fellers than what we profess to be. The house of prayer converted into a marketplace is all around. And Jesus' destructive, violent actions are forever renowned. On one hand, the peacemaker, on the next, force resounds. Let us venture into the Father's house as stewards and dare to ask, how we are consumed by a similar zeal in a world where temptation does not mess around. My hope is that the little rhyme that I devised recaps the Lenten preaching theme that temptation does not mess around. And last week's gospel helped us break down the little big word temptation and rebuke. And today we turn to the Gospel of John, which focuses on that Psalm 69 statement that's the word zeal is not very much in the Bible, but here it is, consumed by zeal. I was pastor of a church in northern Ohio and had planned a trip to my first church that I served out of a seminary in Chicago. It was their 100th anniversary, and they were inviting us all back to celebrate. And when my phone rang, and I answered it, it was Elaine's voice on the other end, and she said, "Pastor, I hear you're going to Chicago and taking your family." And I said, "Yes." She said, "Well, I have a friend who has access to football tickets for the Chicago Bears. And would you like tickets?" I said, "Well, my goodness, they're playing the Packers. Of course I would like tickets." If any of you know about NFL football. And so when we went to the service, it worked out well that we could do the church service and I could participate in it and we could have the great celebration and meal afterwards and still make it to the football game. The church anniversary was a great event. It took our boys back to the church, and one of them was old enough to remember when we lived in that church, and he rode his bicycle downstairs in the gym, or his three-wheeler, and we lived in the apartment upstairs. So we had all those great memories. When I sat there in the sanctuary, in the service of celebration of 100 years, I was looked up, and I noticed a hole in the ceiling of the wood. It was wood just like this. And I remembered climbing up over top of the ceiling in the attic of the church, and it was for Maundy Thursday. And I always say I prepare hardest for Maundy Thursday service, and that's the one the least amount of people show up for. But we had drilled a hole and dropped a rope down and put a pulley on it, and so that we could raise a cross right up in the middle of the service. And I was able to tell that story that evening. It was a great time together, in a great mood. But then we went to the football game. Oh, it was a great crowd at Soldiers Field. And this was when the cheese heads were just starting to wear those heads of cheese through the game. And my boys were all excited. As we're sitting there, waiting for the game and watching the fans come to take their seats, we discovered that we were in the place where most of the cheeseheads sat. But as the cheeseheads walked by, the Chicago fans began yelling at them. And it wasn't just yelling, they were yelling profanity at them. And it wasn't just profanity, it was that kind that you and I would be thoroughly insulted to hear. And so I said, what are we going to do to my wife? I guess we better leave. And my son said, overheard, oh, Dad, we can't leave, we can't leave. And so we were trying to make that decision, and those people who had been proclaiming and cursing, they confessed that they were not in their seats. They didn't have tickets for those seats, and they had to move. So we stayed and watched the game. But here's the reason for the story. How are we consumed by our zeal? For at the football game, there was a lot of zealous fans for their team on both sides of the game. At the church, oh, we had a great time. There was about 150 people there. At the football game, there were however many thousands. Soldier Field was jammed. Where is our zeal in such an experience? How much zeal do we have for that sport that we joke and say is our other religion? And how much zeal do we really have for Jesus Christ in the Church of Christ? That's the question that I want to present to us today. Today we leave the synoptic version and we go to the Gospel of John. And today we discover that John lifts up what we normally associate with Palm Sunday of Jesus going into the temple, but in John, there are two versions of that. And so it's obvious that Jesus went into the temple during the time of Passover at different times. He did it every year. It was a time to see people make their sacrifices, that they would go in and they would buy their animal. We also know that the poor people were like Mary and Joseph. They had gone in years before that was required by the Jewish law to go in and make a sacrifice when the child was born. And so when Jesus was born, we read into the Gospels that they went to Jerusalem to have their sacrifice, but they weren't wealthy enough to buy a lamb or a bull. They had to buy a simple little dove and sacrifice the dove. But we know that that always happened, that Jesus participated that in his whole life. But here we are, that something's happened differently. We've learned that there was a great debate in the Jewish world by the Sanhedrin and by Caiaphas, the leader of the temple, that some wanted to bring the animals down from Mount of Olives and have them there in the temple courtyard so people wouldn't have to go up and get theirs and bring it down. And they thought maybe this way they could probably sell more bulls and make more money. So they were there in the courtyard, and that's what Jesus was doing, was driving them out. What would have happened? You see, in the temple, there's the Holy of Holies. There was a lot of zeal for that Holy of Holies. You wouldn't dare take an unsacrificed animal in there. You wouldn't dare let an animal go in. That would just completely, completely make it unholy if that happened and the animal wasn't sacrificed before it went in. So there was great worry and great zeal about the practice of sacrifice. They were definitely consumed by zeal, the sacrifice of animals. Consumed by zeal. Whose zeal are we focusing? Jesus or the temple barons? It was a time that is described in the book of Exodus that expounds upon the giving of the Ten Commandments, which we heard today. And the Ten Commandments are such a beautiful set of commandments. In the world today, we seem to take those as what we're not supposed to do. But actually, when God pronounces the Ten Commandments, it's a liberating action. It says that you and I then know our boundaries. We have guidelines on where we live, and that we will have no other gods before us. We will not be zealous about another god. We'll keep within the framework of our God. We will not be zealous about our neighbor's spouse. We'll stay within the boundaries. The Ten Commandments had a liberating boundary for you and I to live within. But then it also became a book, the Old Testament book, the Torah, became a way for many of the zealots to turn it into some other kind of strong restrictions in our lives. Leviticus 4:13 through 21, for example. If the whole congregation of Israel errs unintentionally and the matter escapes the notice of the assembly, they do any one of the things that by the Lord's commandments ought not to be done and incur guilt, when the sin that they have committed becomes known, the assembly that shall be a bull of a herd for a sin offering and to bring before the tent meeting. The elders of the congregation shall lay their hands on the head of the bull before the Lord, and the bull shall be slaughtered before the Lord. The priest shall make atonement for them, and they shall be forgiven. It is the sin offering for the assembly. That's what the book of Leviticus focused on the Ten Commandments, the sacrifice of the bull for the atonement. What does atonement mean? It means at one with God. You break the word down, at one with God. So they were consumed by the zeal of that was the way to become at one with God. How do we become one with God? Jesus said, stop making my Father's house a marketplace. And that's when the disciples remembered, zeal for your house will consume me. In the world today, there are so many things that consume us. We, the church, are consumed by the things in the world, by the things that are about us. The apostles were consumed likewise. One of the apostles was Simon the Zealot. Zealot, consumed by zeal. Those were zealous Jews claiming the old way of the Torah. And we've got to follow that in order to be the followers of God. Consumed by zeal. How are you and I consumed by zeal? How do we focus upon Jesus? Or are we like the temple barons, protecting the temple in strange ways? I shared the other evening, I was actually in the archaeological site underneath the temple, which is now the Mosque of Omar, the Muslim mosque. But you can still go under and see the place where all the blood was drained down into a storage tank. It was a stone tank, and then had a way for it to drain out. It was so important. And we know that our Lord Jesus Christ eventually replaced that kind of zeal. Today, in the church, I'll ask it one more time, how are you and I consumed by the zeal of a different nature? We're consumed by the worship wars, by someone in the church saying, those old hymns have got to go, and someone else saying, oh no, we can't have the new hymns, or forget the word hymn. It's just songs, just praise songs. I remember in my home church, we were one of the first churches. Yes, we sang all the great hymns, but our pastor introduced praise songs way back when I was a child, long before they were popular. And we would all sing them, and we would know them by heart, and we would just stand up and sing without a hymnal. We didn't have things on the wall at those times. No projections at that time. So we're consumed by our worship wars in the church. The church was often the place that was a part of the social life long before most of us lived. The church was the center. I mean, right here, when they created the Northwest Territory, there was, in a township in Ohio, there would be, the center of it would have the township hall, a church, and a school. All right there in the center. And that was the law. That was the way it was. And they didn't put all the churches down there. They took turns. At one point, a congregational church would be allowed in this township to be the center. And the next one, it would be a Presbyterian. And the next one, it would be a Methodist. And that's the way it was in the township. So the church was a center of every township, the center of the social life. And that's where people went to socialize. That was part of the way we were. That was part of our zeal. But that zeal has changed. It's turned away to a different way of life. No longer do we lift up those favorite hymns as important in our culture. When I sing, "Tell me the stories of Jesus," I love to hear things I would ask him to tell me if he were here. Oh, I know you know that hymn. But that's not our culture. Whatever the hymn is, it's not our culture. I come to the garden alone while the dew is still on the roses, and the voice I hear, that's not our culture. No matter how much I love that, no matter how much you love it, that's not what relates to our culture today. I was serving in a church that I've already referred to in northern Ohio. When I was serving in MacArthur, when the honeymoon wore out and the church was growing into various divisions over the fact that we had grown so much, when I went there, we had 25 people in worship. We grew to over 100 in worship, and it became very chaotic for who was in charge of that church. Some of these new people, we're not going to turn that over to them. When I was young and dumb, I saw that we needed more room in the back of the sanctuary, so I couldn't get anybody to cooperate with me, and I took out the back hymn one day, or the back pew, and I stuck it in a room in the back of the sanctuary. Well, as soon as I did that, that next Sunday, the head deacon came in and said, "That's my pew. Who do you think you are removing my pew?" Things that we're zealous about, even though the pastor made the wrong move, young and dumb. But after being there for 6 years, I was on the regional board of the Christian Church here in Ohio, and they were celebrating a new church start. And I said, "That's wonderful. We need to celebrate and have new churches." I said, "But when are we going to do something about these small churches that are declining? How are we going to find one of them and make it redevelop?" Well, I opened my big mouth, and they came to me and said, "Dennis, we have just the church that needs to be redeveloped up in northern Ohio, south of Cleveland, out in a rural area, dairy farming community, and it's turning into a little suburb. And we want you to go there." So I went there. And we started redeveloping that church. Again, we started with a very small group of people. We didn't have the tools to make a church grow then like we do now. And they were very clear that we were doing it by the seat of our pants. And I said, "Okay, we'll do it." So we went there, and the congregation received me so well. And I said to them, "We need to figure out a way to grow. We need to have greeters." And they said, "We have greeters." I said, "But where are they? You got to walk through the door to greet them." And get the hint here, folks. I said, "We need to put greeters out in the parking lot." They said, "In the parking lot?" I said, "Yeah, I have in the parking lot, then at the door, and then at the other door." And they said, "Well, what good is that going to do?" I said, "When someone pulls up and we don't know them, or we haven't seen them in a while, we need to greet them right at their car. Make sure they know their way out into the church and where to go and find their way." And lo and behold, we had greeters in the parking lot. And they became complaining to me. We've had greeters in the parking lot every Sunday now for 3 months, and we've had no guests. So what are we going to do to get guests? I said, we'll keep working on it. Keep the greeters in the parking lot. We kept the greeters in the parking lot, and lo and behold, one Sunday, a couple came into the parking lot. They greeted them. They welcomed them. And that couple, then the next Sunday, brought their children. And then the next Sunday, they brought their friends, their relatives. And finally, we had about a dozen people out of that one greeting. And it was, the church was excited about the addition. And that was the beginning of expanding that church up north and growing and changing. I'm reminded of a story about how people protected their pews. Another pew story. Before, many years before that, when I was a young boy at the Broad Street Christian Church, we got a new associate pastor. We always had associate pastor with our senior pastor. An associate pastor was young and was married and had a young bride, and she came and sat down in the church, in the pew, for Sunday worship. She reported later why she was so upset. Some member of the church came and said, "You're in my pew." They did not know she was the new associate minister's spouse, and they told her to move. You see what we have our zeal for? And so many times it's the wrong direction in the church. So up in northern Ohio, when I served the church in Medina County, that church began to grow. One Sunday morning, I noticed that the Sunday school was so small. We had three children in Sunday school. I said, "We're canceling Sunday school." Everybody said, "You can't cancel Sunday school." I said, "Yes, we're going to cancel it now. We're going to start it over again in the fall." Well, they went along with that. In the fall, we opened up Sunday school in a new way, in a new opening session, and we organized all summer to promote Sunday school. And in the fall, we had started with 20-some children in Sunday school when we took time to think about it and plan about it. Church was growing. As the church grew, chaos grew. Chaos grew. People were saying, "Well, we like these new members, but we don't like those new members." They didn't say that to the pastor. They said that to each other. "Who does this pastor think he is, bringing in someone like that?" See, what happened was, when I first brought in people, they were educated people, husband and wife, married, have children. One was a lawyer, one was a doctor, one ran a company. Oh, the church loved those. Through Cub Scouts, I helped meet those people and bring them to our church. And that was good. They loved them. But one day, we had a young woman, single, bring her children to church. Oh, I didn't know that, but they were asking too many questions about how could we have them in church. And then it got worse because we had a young man, single, brought his children to church. And I didn't know it till years later, after all the chaos just blew up. And I'm saying, what's going on? We're a growing church. We're worshiping over 100 people. We started with not practically, 25. And the chairman of the church took me out to lunch, and he said, "You don't know this? It was okay as long as you're inviting the whole family to church, middle-class kind of people. But as soon as you invite that single mother on welfare with their children, oh, they don't like that. As soon as you invite a single man to church with his children, that's out of the norm." I said, "Oh, what are we zealous about? What are we protecting?" The church finally went into total chaos, and they decided, I was on sabbatical, I came home from sabbatical, and they decided that they were going to have a hearing for the pastor and have a hearing whether or not I should remain the pastor or not. I was totally shocked. They were going to bring people up front and talk about how I brought these people into church and how these things weren't what we're about. Well, the hearing happened, and they had a big vote, and the vote overwhelmingly voted that I should remain as pastor. But the church was divided. The zeal was a big battle. It wasn't the zeal for Jesus Christ as the zeal for who's in control of this church. All those people who lost the vote left. It was the old guard of the church. We were getting started with saying, how do we start a new church now? They're gone. We have these folks. We came in one Sunday and we noticed that they had put in new sconces up around the church. The old guard snuck in one day and decided they had to have these candles all around the church, mounted them to the walls because they were showing they're still claiming their church. It was a time that I called my faith crisis. My wife and I, one Sunday afternoon, I said, we got to get out of here. I just got to think and pray. So we headed up to Niagara Falls. And we thought and we prayed and we found a place along Lake Erie in a little cave just to sit and look out at the lake just by ourselves and think and pray. And where's God in our lives? And that's when I went into my faith crisis. I said, I'm not sure I can pastor anymore. So I stopped pastoring. I went in and opened my wood shop. Now first I sold insurance and then I opened my wood shop. And then our regional pastor called me up and said, Dennis, we need you back in the church. I said, you don't want me back in your church. You don't want me there during a time that I don't know if I not just don't trust the church, I'm not sure where I am with Jesus Christ in my faith walk. He said, would you go to this church and be their interim? I went to a little tiny church in northeastern Ohio. And as time passed, I was there a year, part-time, continued to sell insurance, start opening my wood shop, and that's when God tapped me on the shoulder and said, you got to be back in the church full-time. Jesus forgives you. You've got to go back to the church. And so I did. But it was such a healing time. It was a time that I knew the difference between the zealous, the unnecessary zealots, and the zealots who were truly about the love of Jesus and the forgiveness of Jesus and the walk with Jesus. It was a time that I became a far better preacher, that I knew how to bring the issues before us, hopefully and prayerfully, in a healing way. I offer those unto you today. We in the church have continued to be in our own wars inside ourselves. And I'm going to share with you, and I'll ask our ushers to come forward and pass out these flyers today. And these flyers, at one point I had shared some of this with church council. It's a very simple message. It's about Fairfield County, how many churches we have, how many people we have in church. This isn't something I usually pass out in church, but I think it's something that we all need to know. As the church has lost its zeal for the love of Christ in so many ways and placed our zeal in the culture today and lifted a culture up as more important than our faith in many, many ways. So the sheet that I'm handing you tells us about religious traditions in Fairfield County, Ohio. It says that the Evangelical Protestant Church in our county has 20,742 people. It says that the mainline church has 17,000 people. And the Catholic Church has 17,500 people. And as you in the back are still receiving yours, I want you to note that I have highlighted that we have 88,997 people, when these statistics were gathered, that are unclaimed to a church in Fairfield County. And I would suspect that most of those people would proclaim themselves as Christian, but they're against the institutional church. They've either had a problem in the church through the church wars, or they just simply said the institution, their anti-institutionalism, and they take that out on the church. So we have a total of 163 churches in the county, with 57,159 people who are members and active. That's out of a population in 2010 of 146,000. It's a growing population, but the church is a shrinking population overall. We gained a tiny bit, by the way, in this last decade. But overall, we the people of the church in the United States of America, we continue to shrink. And now in this county, we're 39% of the population goes to church, and that's high, by the way. Most counties, it's less than that. And notice the Church of Christ, 5 congregations in this county with 1,024 people. What is our calling? Where are we supposed to place our zeal? How are we supposed to make the church be the place for Jesus Christ? That's the question I present to you this morning. And I offer the words of Jesus. Jesus said, "Destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will raise it up." The Jews then said, "This temple's been under construction for 46 years, and will you raise it up in 3 days?" But he was speaking of the temple of the body. After he was raised from the dead, his disciples remembered that he had said this, and they believed the scripture and the word that Jesus had spoken. May you and I work through the crisis of the church. May you and I commit ourselves to following Jesus and finding a new kind of church, what we're calling on Thursday night an emergent church. I hope and pray that we at Grace United Church of Christ will become consumed for what it takes, what God desires to be the church, a congregation in this day and time that will reach all people and be open to all people. In Jesus' name, amen.